The Torah tells us that there are two divergent paths for the Klal Yisrael. Either you will be an exalted nation, you will be lofty, you'll be high, you'll be looked at by the Gentiles of the world as the ultimate people, or the opposite. You'll be oppressed, you'll be downtrodden, you'll be tortured, you'll be persecuted, you'll be chased from one end of the earth to the other. There's no medium ground. There's no status quo for a Jew. The Am HaNifchar, Hashem's chosen people, are either lofty and exalted or oppressed and tortured. And interestingly enough, twice the Torah tells us very clearly the warnings, twice the Torah tells us very clearly the progression and the steps involved in what's going to happen. And in Parshas Kisavo, the Torah delineates line after line. If you don't listen to the Torah, you're going to be cursed, you're going to be tortured, and it's horrific, detailed, and frightening. And at the very end, the Torah describes why is it that all of this bad has befallen you. Tachas asher lo avadat Hashem lokecha besimcha ubetov lev, because you didn't serve Hashem with joy in your heart, with simcha mirov kol, when you had everything good. You were given abundance, you were given plenty, you had it all and you weren't happy. And because of this, everything that has befallen you has happened. All of this is because you didn't serve Hashem b'simcha. Now the problem with the simple reading of the pasuk is it seems to indicate that it's because of simcha, because of joy, or the joy lacking in your avoda that everything's happening, all the bad has happened. The problem is it doesn't make a lot of sense. And it becomes much worse when Rabbeinu Bechai on the pasuk says that's exactly pshat. Make no mistake. That's exactly the pivotal point. If you serve Hashem b'simcha, everything's great, everything's wonderful. If you don't, all of this is going to befall you. And then Rabbeinu Bechai explains that a mitzvah must be done b'simcha b'tov lev, with proper kavana, and he gives a mashal. He says, look what happened to Reuven. Had Reuven known that the Torah would be made on him, had Reuven known that the Torah would testify that he was the one who saved Yosef from the clutches of his brother, he would have taken Yosef on his shoulders and walked Yosef to his father's home. But because Reuven didn't quite do the mitzvah with total absolute dedication, because he didn't have total absolute devotion, he did part, he sort of stopped in the middle, and therefore he didn't reach what he should have. From here you see, says Rabbeinu Chai, you must do a mitzvah b'simcha with proper kavanah. Okay, now that's Rabbeinu Bechai. Now here's the problem. We understand and we know that simcha is a nicety. It's a nice thing that's going to add to your mitzvah. You know, you should sing Zemiras and Shabbos with happiness. You should dance on Simchas Torah with joy in your heart. But where in the world do we ever see simcha being so pivotal and being so integral that with it you succeed and without it you don't? We don't see that anywhere. It's an addition, it's a nice thing to add to a mitzvah, but simcha is not the essence of your avodas Hashem, problem number one. But problem number two is Rebbeinu Bechai makes a terrible comparison. Why? Because Reuven, had he known that the Torah would testify about him that he was the man who saved his brother, don't you believe that Reuven would have been driven, as great as Reuven was, and as motivated as he was to save his brother's life, knowing that for eternity he would be called the one who saved Yosef, could you imagine the drive, the energy, the enthusiasm with which he would have pursued that? How could you compare that to simcha? Simcha is joy, happiness, smile when you do the mitzvah, pick up a little with, with a smile, but how do you compare the two? So question number one is that simcha is not that essential, it's not that pivotal. Question number two is Rabbeinu Bechai compares it to something that is hugely motivating, and it doesn't seem to bear the comparison. So the question is, what did Rabbeinu Chaim mean? What's pshat in this Rishon, what's pshat in the Pasuk? And to help us understand it, I'd like to share with you a mashal that the Chovos Levavos explains to us. He says as follows. Imagine you have two brothers. These two brothers inherited a field. They don't have enough money to stop what they're doing, but they now own this one field together. They split the field, and the two brothers are very different in their approach. One brother he calls a zariz and a chacham, and the other brother he says, whatever. The first brother, who's the zariz, who's the fellow who's intelligent, what he does is as follows. He says to himself, listen, I can't live off of this field. So I have to get a day job. He hires himself out for his day job. To support himself and his family, he works with someone else's field. But every free moment, any day off, any time he's done his work, he rushes to his field, he plants, he sows, he winnows, he does whatever he can for his own future. His other brother, who's not the Zoriz, who's not so intelligent and not so driven, says to himself, listen, what am I going to do? This field is not going to produce enough for me to live on anyway. He also hires himself out to other people, and anytime he has a free moment, he goes drinking, he goes to the bar, he goes whatever, and he spends his year that way. The Zoriz, the brother who has the wisdom and the drive, spends time every free moment dedicated to this field. Every free moment he has, he devotes to it, and after a while he's able to live off of that field. You see, the crop that it produces eventually can support him. He begins growing further and further. He begins adding new trees, new crops. Eventually his field becomes so profitable that he's able to live off it berevach. He's able to be very successful, and his other brother never succeeds in becoming independent at all. And I believe this mushel that the Chovas HaLevavos gives is very relevant to us. We work for a lot of people. We work for our communities, we work for our spouse, we work for our children. We have many, many, many responsibilities. As a matter of fact, if you do the math, there are 168 hours in a week. If you sleep 7-8 hours a week, there goes 50-60 hours. If you're going to work, as an average man works today, hours and hours, there goes another 60 hours a week. If you add the other responsibilities that you have, everything from paying your bills, to shopping, to cleaning your clothes, to traveling, what you find is that of that 168 hours in the average week, there's very, very little time left for you. Very, very little time left for you to be kona your olam haba, for you to acquire your world to come. And I think this is a tremendous concept. I'll share with you what I mean. I love my job. Baruch Hashem, I'm very happy, and I'm very, very happy with almost everything. The one part of my job that I don't love is the travel. And it gets a little little tiresome, but especially when I have to leave my kids. But I trained my kids when they were little. Whenever I go on an overnight trip, anyway, if I ever get on a plane, whenever I'd come back, I'd bring them back a gift. I didn't want them to feel that I was leaving them, I was abandoning them, so whenever I would go anywhere for any length of time, I'd come back with something. It got to the point that if I even passed by an airport, my kids would line up, Abba, where'd you get me? Where'd you get me? Okay, here's the point. My kids expected that when I came back, there was something there. Most people that I speak to are unhappy. The vast majority of people that I meet are not happy. Now, if you're a Gentile and you're not happy, I understand it. If you have no purpose in existence, if you don't understand why you're here, if you're just whatever, I understand why you're unhappy. But how do you explain Jewish people from people who are learning, who are davening, who are fundamentally unhappy, who don't have a simchas achayim, who don't have joy in their heart, don't have a smile on their face? Would you like to know what a big contributor to that is? You see, every night I lie my head on the pillow and my neshama returns to Shemayim. And my neshama knows exactly what the score is. And my neshama, in that moment of clarity, says, what did you bring me back? You went into that world. In that world, there were diamonds in the streets. You could accomplish, you could grow. What did you bring me back? You brought me back your half-baked chesed. You brought me back that daf yomi when you were falling asleep. You brought me back that tefillah where you were spaced out. This is what you went into the world for. This is what you accomplished in your 24 hours. And when I come back into my body, and I come back to my state of alertness and attentiveness, there's a sense of, ugh, what did I bring me back? What did I do for me? You see, what the Chovas HaLevavos is telling us is you will be busy in this thing called life. You have to earn a living. You have to take care of many, many things. And there isn't that much time left. If you're a Zoriz and a Chacham, you devote yourself to those few hours with tremendous dedication and with tremendous energy, because you recognize the fact, I don't have that many hours in a week devoted to me. I don't have that much time to spend on my world to come. And the little time that you have, you spend with tremendous energy and tremendous zeal. If you're not a chacham, if you're not a zoriz, whatever. Your main time, your main energy is spent on earning a living, going about being busy in this world, and the little bit of time that you do spend on you is spent half-baked, half-focused, and you have this empty sense because you are living a very empty existence. Okay, let me ask you a question. And I mean this question in a very serious way, and I'd like you to at least in your mind answer the question right away. But I mean to say, don't think about it, don't sort of like, does he mean it or not, answer the question. The question is, did you put on tefillin today? Yeah, did you put on tefillin today? Now, obviously you're going to say, of course I put on tefillin today, what do you think? Here's the question, how do you know that you put on tefillin today? I mean, how do I know? Come on, I download a minion, and everybody in the minion puts on tefillin, so I put on tefillin. What kind of stupid question is that, right? Okay. Let's focus on something for a minute. I want you to imagine that you're standing next to a tzaddik, and you get to pick him, whoever he may be, if you wanted to be the Chofetz Chaim, you wanted to be a Tana, whoever you pick as that exalted human being. And you notice that when he puts on tefillin, there's a joy, there's a happiness. His face lights up and there's wow. And you stand next to him and you put on your tefillin. Here's the question. Why does he feel such a powerful experience? Why for him is this a peak experience of life where he's feeling joy, he's feeling meaning, he's really aglow? And for you and me, it's just whatever, you know, I gotta put on tefillin. So I'd like to share with you that there are two distinctions, two differences between this tzaddik and us. Distinction number one is that this tzaddik understands that he's a ben olam haba. You see, I know that I'm going to live forever. This body, I'm going to be in it forever and ever. I'll always be young. I'll always be healthy. I'll never get old, and I'll surely never die. That's the one fact that's so clear. That's the one fact that I live my existence with so clearly in front of me that you see it operating all day, every day. That one fact that I will never die is 100% clear to me. The tzaddik doesn't quite have that perspective. The tzaddik understands that he's here for a few short years. He understands that Hashem put him into this body, that Hashem gave him this temporary thing called life for him to grow. And what he understands is when he's done his job here, his body is the shell, it's the coat, it's put in the ground, and he separates. Not his alter ego, not his distant cousin, not some scaled down version. He, the one who thinks, the one who feels, leaves the body behind, and he forever is what he shaped himself into. The difference between me and the tzaddik is Olam Haba, the world to come, has no relevance to me because I'll never be there. I'll be dead. I'll be asleep. My neshama, whatever that is, will go there, my distant cousin. But I'll be dead, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I do mitzvahs, I don't do mitzvahs, I learn, I daven. It's all irrelevant. Why? Because I'll be dead. And the first concept that the tzaddik understands that we don't is that it's exactly him, and it's exactly the opposite. The body is but the spacesuit. It's but the cloak that you wear, and you take it off, and when you're done your job, you separate. You, with all of your thoughts, all of your memories, the guy inside leaves the body behind. And of course, to the tzaddik, Olam Haba is very relevant. Why? Because it's him. And what he does here with his time is greatly relevant to him, because forever and ever and ever, he is what he made himself into. So the first concept that the tzaddik understands that we don't is, number one, he's a ben olam haba. But there's a second concept. There's a second concept that might be even more significant. Sheldon Adelson was a rags-to-riches story. Sheldon Adelson was a young boy growing up in Chicago. At about 12 years of age, he began his first business. His parents were immigrants. He was born to poverty, but he was a very industrious, very ambitious young man. He bought and sold business after business, business after business. Eventually, he owned Comdex, which was a large large show. Eventually, he bought the Sands Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas, and he became a fantastically wealthy individual. In 2003, he took the Sands Venetian public. Now, Forbes magazine loves to count other people's money. Well, Forbes magazine counted that in about a year and a half, Sheldon Adelson went from being a wealthy guy to being the fifth wealthiest guy in the world. He increased his wealth by 750%. They say he was gaining wealth at such an accelerated rate that he was making $1 million an hour. Every hour during that year and a half, he was becoming $1 million richer. Now, I want you to imagine with me what it's like to make $1 million an hour. Okay, listen, you sit down to lunch, you know, you're doing okay, so you take a little while, and you fold your napkin when you're done. Whoa, $1 million richer, wow. You go for a nice little dip in a pool and get out. Whoa, 750 grand, this is great. Go for a Shabbos shluf, 3 hours later, $3 million richer, wow. Life is great, this is astonishing, I love life. Earning $1 million an hour is a lot of fun. Okay, when I was first beginning yeshiva, it wasn't so popular as it is now, and the average guy didn't go to yeshiva. The average guy went to college and basically closed the Gemara after high school, if he learned in high school at all, and it was over. Now, Baruch Hashem, I was very, very involved in learning, and my chevra in yeshiva were very focused, but every once in a while, I would have one of the guys from the old days would come by, and it was interesting how they related to the yeshiva guys. And you really got the sense, like, why are you guys wasting your time? Come on, get out. We're growing. We're in college. We're going to be lawyers and doctors and Indian chief. You're wasting your time here by the Gemara. Now, it wasn't much of an assignment to me, to be honest. But it happened to be one day, I remember during Musa Seder, thinking of the following mushal. The mushal was like this. I'm sitting in a sandbox. Me and my chavrus are sitting in a sandbox, except one thing. It's not sand. No, it's covered with wood. There's lots of stuff. We're both sitting there. But instead of sand, they're diamonds. And I pick up a 2-carat diamond, and I show it to my chavrus. I say, you like this? She's like, nah, yeah, it's got a little flaw. I put it down. What about this one? Oh, yeah, that's nice. He puts it in his pocket. He picks up one. Do you like this? Oh, that's 4-carat. Oh, yeah, it is. I'll take that. Okay. We go back and forth. You know, he takes a diamond. I take a diamond. He takes one. I take one. And then one of our buddies from the old day comes by holding this big stone. What are you guys wasting your time there with those little rocks? This is a rock. You guys are wasting your time. You should use some of my earth stones. These are real valuable stuff. Nara Dubis. That's a rock. It sells for 10 cents in a landscaping store. These are diamonds. And the currency of the world to come is so valuable and so incomparable to anything in our world that there is no basis for comparison. $1 million an hour pales in comparison. If for a fleeting glimpse we got to see the reward in Olam Haba, we'd be drunk. One single word of learning, one time that you put on tefillin, one time that you actually paid attention during davening and said Baruch Atah Hashem. The reward is astonishing and unbelievable, better than counting diamonds, better than $1 million an hour, and that's the second concept that the Adam Gadol, the Tzaddik, understands. Number one, he understands that it's him in Olam Haba, not his distant cousin, not his alter ego, it's him and it's forever. He understands that his body is going to be buried, he'll leave this earth, and what he shaped himself into will be forever. But number two, he understands the currency. He understands the value. He understands the huge, huge accomplishments in but a moment of time. And so he's drunk with a love of life, drunk with a tremendous drive to accomplish. And when he does something, what as we would call mundane, like putting on tefillin, it's with a joy, it's with a simcha, because he understands the effect it has on him, on the upper world. He's tuned in. And I believe that that's exactly pshat in Rabbeinu Bachai. You see, what Rabbeinu Bachai is teaching us is a simon to whether you understand what you're doing is simcha. You see, if you do mitzvahs and they're whatever, you know, I put on tefillin, I learn, I daven, it's boring, whatever, you're not tuned in. You don't have a clue. You're living a mundane, totally physical world. You're a ben olam hazeh, and you're totally locked into this world. You understand push-ups and diet. If I do a lot of push-ups, my muscles grow. If I eat the right foods, I lose weight. You're a shtick flesh, you're a physical entity. You're living a physical existence, and that's why mitzvahs mean nothing to you. Mitzvahs mean nothing to you because you feel you'll live forever, and you feel that the current state will be forever, and you're not plugged in. If you understood the value, if you understood the impact, what would happen would be you'd be supercharged and you'd do them with tremendous joy. And a mitzvah done with simcha is infinitely greater than one done without it. Not so much because of the simcha per se, but because it's a totally different type of mitzvah. You see, if you really understand what you're doing, it's driven, it's focused, it's tremendous, and if not, it's whatever. The Or HaTzaddikim uses a very clear expression. He says the difference between doing a mitzvah besimcha and doing a mitzvah without is 1,000 times in effect. The Rishonim do not use words flippantly. He says doing a mitzvah besimcha is 1,000 times more effective. Your one block Gemara, your one Mishnah, your one Shemona Esrei is 1,000 times more effective. Why is it? Because qualitatively it's a totally different mitzvah. Fundamentally it's different because you're plugged in, you understand, and that mitzvah is so many times more powerful. And I believe that's exactly what Rabbeinu Bachai is saying. Do you know why this is the pivot? Not because Simcha is not so happy, so important, not because what Breslov is over here. The reason why it's so significant is because it's indicative of your entire Avodas Hashem. What it shows is, who are you? Are you plugged in? Do you understand why you're here? Do you understand what's life about? Do you understand the value and the impact? If you did, you'd be happy, you'd be joyful. If you don't, what it means is you're just physical, you're flatlined. Effectively, your Avodas Hashem is dead. And a dead Avodas Hashem doesn't work. It doesn't empower you, it doesn't change you, it doesn't catapult you to the heights. But if you're really plugged in to the value, to the accomplishments, there's a superpower to your mitzvahs, there's a charge, there's an energy, and that brings you joy. The joy is significant as a siman, as an indicator of the impact of the mitzvah upon you, upon your understanding, and it's a siman, it's an indicator of how you're serving Hashem. And I think this concept is very, very applicable in our times. As I mentioned, it's very, very unusual, but it's very, very common. You'll find Jews who learn, who daven, who seem to do everything right, and they walk around with this look. I don't want to plug the book, but the title of the book is Stop Surviving, Start Living, because if you ask the average person today, how are you doing, hanging in there, surviving. And from the back of the book, you can read the words that hanging in there, surviving, are the appropriate words when the doctor just told you you have terminal cancer. If you were just convicted of 20 years of solitary confinement, someone says, how you doing? Surviving is an appropriate response. For a man living in the lap of luxury, living in a land of freedom, being able to create your destiny, being able to shape your life exactly as you want to shape your life, being able to grow, being able to accomplish, to say the word surviving, hanging in there, is a very poor description of life. But if it well describes the life you're living, then something's lacking. And I'd like to share with you the formula for changing that. If you would like to know the two things needed to really enjoy life, to have a simchas achayim, the first one is you have to learn how to count. Most people don't know how to count. I'll explain to you what I mean. I was speaking to a fellow who is on Atzala, excuse me, and he told me an interesting story. He was on a call, and it was a cardiac arrest. He and his partner are rushing to the scene. Cardiac arrest means you don't have that much time till the patient is not there. They get there, they're about to park, and the call is canceled. What do you mean the call is canceled? Where the guy have a heart attack and just, oh, he's all better now, forget it, cancel. You don't cancel a cardiac arrest. You don't, like, has a heart attack stop. You don't know what to make of it. He parks the car and figures, let me go in anyway. Happened to have been a cardiologist's office where the call was. They enter the office and they see the doctor. There's a woman spread out on two chairs. The doctor's taking a sheet and he's putting it over her to say it's all over. And they walk in with their equipment. And they turn to the doctor and they say, did you try CPR? Nah, she's gone. Well, I mean, you know, did you at least try? Nah, it's too late. Do you mind if we, they didn't wait for a response. They took her, put her on the floor, began CPR, and the doctor starts yelling, get out of my, what are you doing? They didn't pay much attention. They began CPR. They began working on her, and they brought her back. They saved the woman's life. She was about 60. And that means, you know, according to the normal ways of the world, she has a lot more left to live. This fellow and his friend saved this woman's life. You know what it means to save a person's life? Kolamatzil nefesh echas b'Yisrael. If you save a Jewish person, kolamatzil, it's as if you saved the world. But this fellow didn't begin Hatzalah yesterday. This wasn't the first life-saving call he was on. He's been on quite a number of life-saving calls, and quite a number of times he's been called to the scene. Not every situation is as grave as serious, but every single call he's been on has been very, very real to the person he was called to. The least serious are when a person has a major break in an arm or a leg or something. The point being, he's involved in many, many acts of great chesed. And then he said something to me very, very interesting. He said, I've been on Hatzalah about 12 years. I've been on about 15,000 calls. 15,000 times in this person's life, he's literally changed another human being's destiny. What that means in plain language is his Olam Haba is hard to imagine. Could you imagine what it's like to walk into Shemayim having 15,000 of such or similar acts on your chesed? He's not over yet. He's all 33. But you have to know how to count. And you have to remember that what we do on the positive is ours forever. What we do on the negative is ours forever as well. But one doesn't cross out the other. And here's the point that most people miss. The way to buy your Olam Haba is not just by being on Hatzalah. There are many other ways to buy your Olam Haba. There are things called 613 mitzvahs. There are many, many ways that Hashem gave us to earn our world to come. And what the point you have to remember is, every single one of them is a permanent investment in me. But a permanent investment that's beyond my recognition, beyond my realm of understanding. And what that means is, if I learn, if I daven, if I give tzedakah, if I do what I'm supposed to, there's a reward that's hard to imagine in terms of what's waiting for me. If you daven three times a day, do the math. It's about 1,000 times a year. You live a nice long life. It's 50, 60, 70,000 times you'll daven. What if you actually make 100 brachas a day? Times 365, somewhere over 35,000 a year. What if you live a long, ripe life? You might well be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim 1,000,000 times. Acknowledge Hashem's presence, recognize Hashem's existence, and say the word, blessed be you, Hashem, my God, Melech HaOlam. You may say those words 1,000,000 times in your life. And if you don't yet recognize the value of life, there's something called Limud HaTorah. When Chazal say Talmud Torah Shokol Keneged Kulam, it means qualitatively and quantitatively. Qualitatively means it's the single most valuable mitzvah, greater even than saving a person's life. But quantitatively, what it means is it's not 100 brachas a day. Every word, every single word is a mitzvah b'fnei atzma. If I sit down and read a Mishnah, that's 10, 20, 40, 50 words. If you learn a black gemara, what's a black gemara? Daffy Yomi, come on, whatever. I have my Starbucks coffee in this hand. I got my art scroll in the other. It's such a big deal. I mean, I should do it. I know, but you're making a big deal out of it. If we understood what Limud HaTorah was, if we understood what one mitzvah was, we'd be drunk with our wealth. We'd understand that I'm a rich person. I'm phenomenally wealthy. I two off all day long. I accomplish, I do. Every time I act like a mensch, every time I'm nice, I'm proper, I'm sweet, every time I act as I should, I'm accomplishing worlds, I'm putting investments permanently into my bank account. And of course, the flip side of that is what the flip side is. But you see, the point is that you have to know how to count. And you have to remember that I'm making it. I'm getting richer and richer, far more than $1,000,000 a year, and far more than $1,000,000 an hour. I'm becoming phenomenally wealthy. So the first thing you have to know is you have to know how to count. But there's a second problem. The second problem is you have to know how to understand nisyonos. Unfortunately, I have a little bit of a guarantee for you. I guarantee that no matter who you are, No matter how great you are, you will suffer. It's part of life. You will suffer physically, you will suffer emotionally. That's just part of the landscape of life and is a very particular reason for it. Much of what we go through is to allow us to change, to allow us to grow. But the point is, every one of us will suffer and every one of us will have nisyonos. And the vast majority of people completely misunderstand what a nisayon is. And most people, if you ask them what's a nisayon, they'll tell you like this: listen, I was doing great, I was learning in yeshiva, I was steiging, and then I had this nisayon. The nisayon is just the thing I had to get over, right? I had to get past it. If I could get past my temper, if I could get past my ego, if I could get past taiva, then I would, you know, go on to grow. But the nisayon was the obstacle. It was an obstacle in my path. The whole goal was to get past the obstacle so I can go on to what I should be doing. It's very rare that that's what a nisayon is. If you'd like to understand what a nisayon is, I'll share with you a mashal. Many years ago, I was a Rebbe in high school, and I pulled my back. I hurt my back very badly, and I ripped one of the erector muscles or two that run along the spine, and I literally couldn't walk. I had a friend of mine in town who was a dentist, who was also a powerlifter, and he said, listen, you come down to the gym, the coach will put you back together, one, two, three. So I went down to the gym, and I spent a certain amount of time powerlifting. And it was a very interesting experience. It was very intense, very focused, and I happened to have really enjoyed it. Okay. Anyway, at one point, I was speaking to one of the fellows who was still in Kollel, and he also had some physical issues. So I told him, why don't you come down? The coach is a real understanding guy. He'll work with you, you know, and he'll help you. Now, it happens to be that this fellow was very yeshivish, had no physical background, didn't play ball as a kid, and it was really a little bit of an interesting scene to watch him walk into the gym. Now, the coach is probably the single widest human being I've ever seen in my life. He used to bench press 400 pounds. We're talking like more weight than most people can deadlift. He put 400 pounds on a bar and just... Okay. In walks this very yeshivish guy, and the coach takes one look at him and understands what he's dealing with. But he was a very good individual, and he worked with him very carefully. And he showed this fellow how to lift, he showed him how to stand, he showed him how to grip, and he worked with him for a few weeks, and this yeshivish fellow was getting good at it. He was getting the motion down, he was starting to get, you know, pretty much acclimated to the gym, and he was starting to really accomplish. One day, this fellow says to me, you know, that coach, I don't know what's with him. Every time I get the motion right, he goes and puts more weight on the bar. What's wrong with that guy? The whole point of progressive weight training is to increase the resistance. You put more load on the body, and when you put more load on the body is forced to respond. The kunst isn't to lift the empty bar, it's to put more weight to force your body to grow more. Most people look at nisyonos like this. I got to get past this nisyon. Once I get past the nisyon, then I'll get on to life. That's oftentimes the point of it. It's the fight, the wanting to and not wanting to. Seeing something that you know you shouldn't be looking at and fighting the fight and winning, oftentimes that's the whole point of it. Much like weight training, where it's forcing your body to grow, the nisyon is in and of itself a tremendous opportunity of growth. And it's a Gemara in Makkos. The Gemara in Makkos, Chav Gimel on the Beis, says that every time you resist, if you have an nisayon, and to you it's an nisayon, and you resist, you're given schar. It's not just that you're given the opportunity not to mess up. It's not just that then you can continue on your way. That is a glorious moment in your life. If you actually resist, if you actually don't do what you're not supposed to do, you've grown, you've changed, and that's a crowning, shining moment in your history. If you know how to count and you understand nisyonos, you look at life very, very differently. All of the pain, all of those yuck, I got to go through that again, I got to be the ugh, all of that stuff, you have a very, very different vantage point on. The Aruch HaTzaddikim says, if you understood nisyonos, you understand the pain that you feel is real, but that pain is like trading copper coins for gold bars. In the world to come, the reward that's waiting for you is vast and unimaginable. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's hard. But what's waiting for you is unimaginable. If you know how to count and you understand the nisyonos, you wake up in the morning with a love of life. Wow, 24 hours where I can grow, I can accomplish. 24 hours where I can change the essence of me. 24 hours at the end of which I'm going to be a different person. And you know what happens? with that attitude, there's a simchas achayim, there's a joy, there's a happiness. Why? Because you understand life, you understand the opportunity of life, and you grow, you accomplish, you're a different human being. Mitzvahs are vastly different, davening is different, learning is different. When you pick up a lulav and esrog, it's wow, you know what I'm accomplishing? What Rabbeinu Bachai is teaching us is a fundamental concept. If your mitzvahs are flat, if you're just going through the motions, it's not that they're lacking in a certain nicety. It's not like you're doing okay, but there's something lacking. Fundamentally, you don't get it. You're not in the game. You don't understand what life's about. You don't understand what you're doing here. And what you're doing is you're functioning flatline, almost like a dead person. If you're not happy, if you're not enjoying them, what that means is you're not plugged in. And if you'd like to take your temperature, if you're ever curious to know where you're holding this thing called Ruchnius, I dare say this is an interesting indicator. How happy are you? You see, if you're really, really growing, if you're really, really accomplishing, you can't help but be happy. Even if your life is difficult, even if you're suffering, you can't help but be happy. And you know why? Because there's one core cognition that you come to. I did not ask to be born in this generation. I did not ask to be given this personality. I did not ask to have a temper or arrogance or taiva or whatever my nesoyin is that was given to me. And I understand that Hashem handpicked that for me because it fits me like a hand in glove. And I understand that Hashem is more merachem than any merachem. Hashem loves me. Hashem chose this for my good. And I understand that every moment of my life is valuable, is precious, because I'm accomplishing, I'm growing, and with that tremendous understanding, life becomes precious. When you learn how to count, when you learn what nisyonos mean, life itself has a tremendous happiness, a tremendous joy, and there's a passion for life. And again, Rabbeinu Bachai says, that's the pivotal point. Why is that the pivotal point? Because that's the indicator of everything that you're doing, how you're doing it. And at the risk of saying it, we live in remarkable times. When I was a boy growing up, there was nowhere near as much learning, nowhere near as much avodas Hashem. It was very, very different. And yet, while it's tremendous, while it's very impressive, one of the things you have to wonder about is, where is the joy, where is the simcha? And if that's lacking, it's not a nicety. It's not like, yeah, Betzim, we're doing great, but there's a little piece lacking. It indicates that everything, the essence of it, is lacking. And I think it's something that's tremendously important. Rabbeinu Chai is teaching us, you have to enjoy mitzvahs. You have to be totally involved. Why? Because that's the power. The difference between doing it with real passion and without is a difference between 1,000 times effectiveness. And it's a difference of whether these mitzvahs empower you forever, whether they're really accomplishing for you. You see, if you ride on a tzala wagon, you saved the person's life, whether you had the right kavanah or you didn't. The person was going to die, you saved them, your olam haba is intact. But you see, if you're davening, but you're not really connected, if you're davening, but you're not speaking to Hashem, if you're learning, but it's like, whatever, if you're putting on tefillin, but it's like, you know, did you put on tefillin? Didn't? I don't know. What's my arm supposed to tingle? If you're not really accomplishing what the purpose of the mitzvahs are, then they're flatline. Are they worth doing that way? They sure are. The reward for them is tremendous, but you can multiply the effectiveness by 1,000 times. That's exactly what the Aruch HaTzaddikim says. And if you understand that, you change your essence, and you change your life. Because if you start understanding, I'm a Ben Olam Haba, I'm put in the world for a few short years, but who I am for eternity is being shaped right now. My thoughts, my intentions, how I act, what I say changes me. If you understand that every moment is an opportunity to change me, and I will be there forever, not my distant cousin, not my alter ego, me, and I will be there dependent on what I use my time for, and the rewards or the punishments are tremendous beyond our understanding. When you focus on that, you have a different vantage point, a different understanding. Life itself is very, very different. Let me close with one last thought. In the time of the Agra, there was the famous Ger Tzedek. This person had been born to a noble family. He was in the Polish royalty. And apparently he began learning, began studying, and he became a Ger. In those days, the Catholic Church did not take very kindly to Jews becoming popular, and certainly didn't take kindly to Gentiles becoming Jews. And it became a tremendous busha to the Catholic Church. And they did everything in their power to chase this person down. Eventually they caught him and they brought him in. Now, the Catholic Church was famous for various things. One of the things they were very famous for were tortures. They used to invent the most painful, unimaginable tortures, and it was clear that they were going to use every one on him because this was a cause célèbre. A person of his stature to join the Jews was a tremendous busha. The Gros knew this individual, and the Gros sent a messenger to prison to tell him that if he wishes, the Gros will get him out. How the Gros intended to do it isn't 100% clear, but it was clear that the Gros was not going to send a letter to the governor. The Gros let him know, if you want, I'll get you out. The garrison backed the message, no, I'd rather die, al Kiddush Hashem. He knew exactly where he was headed. They tortured him for weeks, day after day, the most horrendous, unimaginable tortures. He wouldn't budge, he wouldn't change. Finally, they saw there was no hope. They decreed him to death. The night before he was to die, the head inquisitor, the priest who was the leading torturer, walks into his cell, tears in his eyes, and says, I know that I'm wrong. I know that what I've done, I'm going to suffer for tremendously. Please forgive me. Please promise me that before you leave this earth, you'll forgive me. The Ger Tzedek looks at this priest and says, forgive you? Let me give you a mushel. Let me give you a parable. There was once a king, and he's sitting on the throne. Into his throne room walks this person who falls on his face and begins crying, your majesty, forgive me for what I've done. Your majesty, forgive me for... Stand up, man. What are you asking forgiveness for? Your majesty, don't you remember when we were children, we used to play, and many times I would wrestle with you, I'd throw you on the ground, many times I'd call your name, your majesty, forgive me, please. We were kids. We were little kids. That's what little kids do. It has no meaning. I don't have to forgive you. You don't have to ask forgiveness. There's nothing to forgive. Says the Garrett to this priest, when we leave this earth, we'll see it was all child's play. It was all irrelevant. It didn't matter. I don't have to forgive you. There's nothing to forgive you for. That ability to transcend, that ability to be so above the fray, to see this world for what it is, a grand opportunity, a grand stage with the props in place, with all of the chances for me to grow, for me to change, but all of the props don't matter. Not the honor, not the money, not the reputation. It's all hevel havolim. It's all frivolous. It's all empty. It's all silly. There's only one thing. It's called me, what I do for me. Hashem wants every one of us to grow, to accomplish, and Hashem put us in the world to change, and Hashem gave us this unbelievable opportunity. We have to be very, very busy at this thing called life. You're going to have to earn a living. You're going to have to spend hours and hours and hours and hours doing things for other people. If you do them right, you do them with emunah, you're given schar for that also, but that little bit of time that you have for you, you have to consider it precious, you have to invest it properly, and you have to understand how precious it is, and you have to relish it. If you do, you increase your potential, you increase your potency 1,000 times. There's a simchas lechayim. We're not here to be happy in this world. It's a natural totzah, it's a natural result, and it's a great indicator. When a person lives his life properly, he enjoys this world, and he enjoys the world to come, and if a person doesn't, both never really happen. Hashem grant us the wisdom and understanding to put this into place. Before I end, I just want to mention two things. One is the Shmuzin Aparsha book is on sale. It's $19.95. It's normally $24.95 for Bracious. We put it on sale. There are copies in the back. Also, we have the Stop Surviving, Start Living book in paperback if you haven't gotten a chance to get a copy. The $10 are also in back, and there are also other CDs in back for sale. If anyone has questions, please feel free to come over.
Thank you very much, first of all.